This podcast of Word of Mouth is sponsored by
Northeast Credit Union, helping their members save money through free checking accounts and refinancing of auto, home, and personal loans.
Northeast Credit Union, encouraging you to discover the difference at necu.org.
Federally insured by NCUA.
Equal housing opportunity.
And Dartmouth Hitchcock.
Creating a new model for healthcare.
Where leading health systems collaborate to improve care for all of us.
A sustainable system
improving the health of our communities
for years to come.
Information at imagine.d-h.org.
And Doucet Survey.
Serving your professional land surveying and mapping needs in New England.
Now with offices in New Hampshire and Maine.
Information at doucetsurvey.com. That's doucetsurvey.com.
Word of Mouth.
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 Mouth.
This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Virginia Prescott. From where the sun now stands, I will fight no more forever. With that memorable declaration, Chief Joseph of the Nez Perce surrendered in 1877 to General Nelson Miles. His words signaling a noble submission, a white flag, knowing when you're lost and being willing to lay down your weapons in defeat. Now wars are borderless, conflicts are ideological, and battles are fought door-to-door in cities and in gruesome videos posted online. Today, declarations of surrender are increasingly rare, almost antiquated, and the world is caught up in what seems like a never-ending series of wars. So what happened? Carlin Romano is critic at large for the Chronicle of Higher Education, where we found his article, Whatever Happened to Surrender, which contains a lot of the lessons he learned from the anthology How Fighting Ends. It's a history of surrender, edited by Holger Offlerbach and Hugh Strachan. Carlin Romano joins us now from Beijing, where he is currently teaching. And Carlin, welcome to Word of Mouth.
Thank you. Thank you for liking the article.
Well, it was really interesting being reminded that formal surrender used to be the way to end conflict, which we heard a lot about this year at the 150th anniversary of the Civil War, reminded of General Robert E. Lee's surrender to Ulysses S. Grant. So what happened there that we don't see anymore?
Well, one thing I learned from this book that I relied on a lot in writing the piece, and I really do recommend it to people because they really take us back all the way to prehistoric times. And way back then, surrender was kind of a non-starter. Losers just got killed. So it's really, it seems, in the Middle Ages and into the modern era where surrender becomes a possibility. It's not totally dishonorable. As for today, I mean, one of the things I mentioned in the article was that we don't have clear-cut winners and losers in the way that we used to.
Why is that? Is it the nature of warfare? Are today's combatants ideologically unwilling to admit defeat, or there's just no end in sight?
Well, the book is fascinating on that. One thing that surprised me is that today a lot of military outfits, and particularly the outfits run by states rather than by terrorist groups, don't really go all out for victory. And one of their aims is actually casualty avoidance. And I think, you know, when we see current U.S. policy, whether you agree with it or disagree with it, we understand that we're often trying to avoid casualties, right, with our use of drones and so on. So partly it's that people don't go all out to win anymore. And of course, we have the constraints of the Geneva Convention and laws of war, which didn't really govern things in prehistoric times. So the kinds of things, for instance, that we did, the Allies in World War II, the firebombing of Dresden, killing lots and lots of noncombatants, is really considered unacceptable today for civilized countries. That also makes it hard for clear-cut victors to emerge.
Well, we know Neanderthals didn't, you know, shake hands and drink sherry and agree to stop fighting. What do we know about the origins of surrender rather than just killing the vanquished?
Yeah, well, it seems like mankind had to go pretty far before it really got to the point of accepting surrender. There are a lot of examples in the book, and I mentioned some in my article about how, you know, in ancient Greece, for instance, the Spartans told their soldiers to return, quote, with your shield or on your shield, but not without your shield. You know, you're really supposed to fight, you know, to the death. One thing that seemed to happen in the Middle Ages is that victors recognized that losers and prisoners had value, particularly in regard to knights. So knights often had very wealthy friends and families that would ransom them. And that meant that victors began to think, gee, even if I don't want to feed these prisoners, even if I don't want to take them with us, there's a way to deal with them rather than killing them. You know, we can start negotiating, we can start talking. And as soon as victors and losers started to talk, the possibility of what a lot of the scholars called honorable surrender began to emerge.
How about the whole notion of the white flag? When did that symbolism become used?
Well, it's interesting. White flags actually go back to the Romans. But one of the things I learned, contrary to what I thought I knew, is that a white flag in international law actually doesn't constitute surrender. What it means in international law is we like to talk about surrender. And another interesting aspect of surrender throughout the centuries is that there's something the scholars call failed surrender or tricky surrender, where one party pretends to surrender to draw out the other party and then attacks them.
How about this idea of these genteel rules in honor of engagement? You know, the idea that two generals would just shake hands and say, okay, we're not fighting anymore. How did that era and that way of ending conflicts arise?
Well, it does seem, I mean, an observation that pops up at different places, you know, in the book and in the history of scholarship about surrender is that surrender is a lot more possible between opponents who share a culture. And if they share a culture, they may share mutual respect. So you referred to the famous, you know, meeting between Robert E. Lee and Ulysses Grant at Appomattox. And that was an example of that, where General Grant decided that the soldiers would be allowed to leave with their full honors, their horses and their weapons, because he respected Robert E. Lee. And despite all the bloodshed and the mayhem, there was a respect between the rival armies. One difficulty that I think we have today when we're fighting, say, Boko Haram or Islamic State, is that, as we've seen, there's virtually no agreement on values. There's a belief you can behead people, whether they're innocent or guilty or for the slightest deviation from Islamic belief. So when the two sides really have an enormous cultural gap, it's hard to reach that gentlemanly stage.
Carlin Romano is with us, and he wrote Whatever Happened to Surrender for the Chronicle of Higher Education. In it, he explores the concept of surrender, which is increasingly rare in today's global-scale warfare. Carlin, contemporary culture abhors this notion of being a loser. So are conflicted parties or fighting bodies today desperate to avoid that kind of stigma of being called the loser?
I do think that is something that has kind of continued throughout history. It's particularly strong early on. I mean, that's what the Spartans were talking about. One of the scholars in this book who wrote about the Roman period wrote that any Roman who did surrender disgraced himself, you know, and his family. So the further back you go in history, it seems the idea that surrender is a disgrace is very powerful. Then a phrase comes up in the scholarship, which I think captures what we're talking about here, sensible surrender. And it's the idea that, you know, when all is lost, when there's nothing you can do against your opponent anymore, it just doesn't make any sense, you know, to keep fighting or force yourself to be killed. And the great writer about war, many people have heard of him, even if they haven't read him, named Clausewitz, German scholar, wrote in a very famous line that all of these people who study surrender quote, that, quote, there is a point beyond which persistence becomes desperate folly and can therefore never be condoned. So he was kind of saying it's just illogical at a certain point to keep fighting. And when everybody began to recognize that, surrender became possible.
How about for a group that is effectively losing a war, losing a battle? What other options are there if not surrender?
Well, one of the traditional options was just to run. I mean, really to like throw your arms down and run as fast as you could and try to get away from the enemy. And that was one way of basically exiting the battlefield. There's something that the scholars called forced surrender, and a particularly strong illustration is the number of times that a horse would fall on a soldier and basically pin the soldier. So there was nothing that could be done. But, you know, basically running, disappearing, fleeing was the standard way to avoid surrender, but avoid also being killed.
And looking back through history, our epic poems, you know, our novels, our songs, and certainly movies, historically have glorified this notion of choosing death over surrender. Why do you think our culture often looks at that kind of sacrifice as heroic, rather than the kind of heroism of saying, let's just stop fighting?
Yeah, well, this was a funny thing I learned from the book also, which is that some of the fighters that you would most expect to live up to that standard, which were the knights in medieval times, were actually the ones most likely to run or to surrender quickly or to quickly send a message to the other side that said, you know, I have very rich friends and a very rich family. Don't kill me. I can get you some money, you know, protect me. And often they were treated extremely well. They might even be invited into the tent and have a nice meal while we contact your cousin, you know. It's a strange thing. But I'd say generally that as individualism grew and as fighters became more upper class than lower class, which they seemed to do in the Crusades and elsewhere, the value of an individual life became very important. Knights didn't want to die for no good reason. When in earlier times, you're basically having the lowest levels of society fight, and their lives are not valued by anyone, and sometimes even not by themselves, you had a greater likelihood that people would kind of go down with the ship and, you know, fight to the last drop of blood.
How about now in this age of the suicide bomber, of Boko Haram, of ISIS? You know, these wars globally publicized online, is the likelihood of surrender becoming even slimmer?
Well, you know, that really does seem to be the judgment of a lot of people who study this, that, you know, one of the co-editors remarks that, quote, the readiness to surrender has rarely been weaker, unquote, you know, in our world today. I think I'd go back to that original idea that prospective winners aren't trying hard enough to win. One thing you see over and over in the history of warfare is that the eventual loser often doesn't give up until the loser's property, family, army has been totally destroyed. There has to be a tremendous amount of pain applied. And the laws of war have in many ways lessened that amount of pain. So I'm not arguing here that we should go back to a pre-Geneva era, but realistic assessment of why surrender has disappeared does seem to be connected to, in a sense, various sides fighting with one hand behind their back. And so battles never get resolved.
Well, Carlin Romano, a lot to think about. Thank you for speaking with us today.
My pleasure. Thank you.
Carlin Romano teaches at Beijing Foreign Studies University. He's also a critic at large for the Chronicle of Higher Education and author of the book America, the Philosophical. And you'll find a link to read his article, Whatever Happened to Surrender, where there's more on the book, How Fighting Ends, A History of Surrender. All of it at wordofmouthradio.org. The mass shooting at an historically black church last week has unleashed a national discussion about racism and bigotry and symbolism and what would motivate accused shooter Dylann Roof to want to start a race war. Well, a recent New York Times op-ed pointed to the idea that Americans tend to view attacks like the mass murder in Charleston as isolated hate crimes. The Southern Poverty Law Center's annual survey on hate groups found differently. While the number of active hate groups is at a 10-year low, white supremacist, anti-immigrant, and anti-government patriot activity is still recruiting and appealing to isolated malcontents globally. It's just been driven underground and is spiking online. We spoke to SPLC senior fellow Mark Protok when the report was released earlier this year and thought the conversation relevant to recent revelations about hate groups online. First, a little on which criteria your study uses to designate a hate group.
Well, what we define as a hate group has nothing to do with criminality or violence or any kind of estimate we're making for the potential for those things. It's strictly about ideology. Does a group say that an entire group of people, by virtue of their class characteristics, is somehow less? In other words, if a group says all white people are blue-eyed devils, all black people are criminals, all the Jews are whatever it may be, those kinds of statements. So that's what we're looking at.
And your reporting since the year 2000, show a big upward trend in hate groups. Can you give us a snapshot of the last decade or so?
Sure. Well, hate groups kind of rose and fell in the 90s, and then they rose very steadily from about 1999 on, peaked in 2011, didn't change much in 2012, and has begun to fall by about, I think it was about 10-12%. Between 2012 and 2013, and 20% between 2013 and 2014. You know, we think what's happening is that people are leaving organized groups but staying essentially within the kind of milieu of the movement. They are increasingly moving onto the internet. It's not like they haven't been there in large numbers before, but what we're seeing is fewer and fewer people wanting to be associated with the groups for a number of reasons. I think a big part of that is that the cost of being exposed as a member or associated with these kinds of groups has essentially gotten higher and higher every year. And more people are being outed, whether it's by journalists or by the Anonymous Hacking Collective or groups like the Southern Poverty Law Center. And that, I think, is driving people into the kind of anonymity of the Internet where they're very active.
Okay, so doesn't mean they've disbanded, but changed form or forums, I guess, online. What are some of those popular forums?
Well, Stormfront is probably the very best known one. Stormfront is a very large web forum run by a former Alabama Klan leader named Don Black. That forum has something very close to 300,000 registered users, so it's enormous. We are seeing large numbers of people move into password-protected forums, in particular on a network called VK, which is a huge Russian social network. People are at the same time being chased off, by people, I mean people in the white supremacist world, are being chased off forums like Facebook. And increasingly going to these somewhat more obscure places. In addition, we see communities forming, for instance, within the Reddit world, a lot of subreddits that are intensely racist, in fact, much more racist than what you will find normally on a forum like Stormfront.
I'm wondering how this underground activity changes the strategy of the FBI or law enforcement or organizations like the SPLC tracking hate groups, in your case, taking legal action against them.
Well, it makes it incredibly difficult. And let me say, this is a very long-running trend. This is not something that just happened in the last year. Really, the extreme right, and to some extent as well, domestic jihadists, have been going in this direction for many, many years. In the case of the radical right, some 30 years. And this has to do with the really the ease with which law enforcement has been able to bust open conspiracies when they involve a fairly large number of people. These people don't seem to be able to keep their mouths shut. And so very often these plots have been stopped. But there's been really a theoretician, a guy named Louis Beam, a well-known Klan leader or former Klan leader, who has been pushing for a long time this idea of act on your own. Don't organize into pyramidically structured organizations. Because if you do, law enforcement, by finding one person, can break apart an entire organization. So to answer your question, lone wolves, or people who operate in pairs, are incredibly difficult to stop because it is so unusual for somehow a leak to develop, for news of that to get out before the actual attack takes place. You know, we can't simply attach a police officer or an FBI agent to every person who has unpleasant or even violent views. And so it's a very, very hard thing.
So, Mark, you and your colleagues at the Southern Poverty Law Center, when you're looking over this new landscape of hate, is it more concerning to you to have active, big groups, vocal, easy to see, swelling numbers, or this online activity going on with smaller cells?
Well, in a lot of ways, the situation we're in now is more worrying. It may seem counterintuitive, but I think the fact is that many of the larger groups, in effect, have had the effect on their members of holding them back. They are, in effect, kind of saying, yes, yes, boys, we'll kill the Jews, but that'll be next week. Because at the end of the day, the leaders of these groups are not interested in going to prison for the rest of their lives, but they are interested in kind of whipping up the troops and being the leader and so on. So we've seen that time and again. The people who really do tend to attack are people who drift away from the groups, who despise them as the meet, eat, and retreat crowd, as they will say. And those really are the lone wolves out there who are almost impossible to predict. I mean, it's just not possible to know what day a certain person will wake up and decide that today is the day to start killing.
So, Mark Potok, thank you for your time.
A real pleasure. Thanks for having me.
Mark Potok, Senior Fellow at the Southern Poverty Law Center. And you can look at more on the SPLC's annual report on hate groups on its Hate Watch blog. There's a link at wordofmouthradio.org.
Word of mouth.
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 Word of
mouth.
This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Virginia Prescott.
Good. Now give us your performance of Iroquois
the
now.
The raging rocks on shivering shocks shall break the locks of prison gates.
That's a clip from a rehearsal of A Midsummer Night's Dream, Shakespeare's sex farce of young love, simmering hormones, and the not always obvious line between real life and the stuff of dreams. Filmmakers Jillian Spitzmiller and Hank Rogerson previously made an acclaimed film about presenting The Tempest in prison. This time, they've set up their cameras at the Lillian Booth Actors Home, a skilled nursing and assisted living facility for Broadway actors and musicians and dancers and other artists whose performing days are far behind them. They follow the cast of residents for a six-week run-up to a public performance of A Midsummer Night's Dream. The film is called Still Dreaming and will be shown this Friday at the HOP, the Hopkins Center for the Arts, followed by a discussion with the Dartmouth alums and my guests today, Jillian Spitzer and Hank Rogerson. Welcome to both of you.
Thank you. So glad to be here.
Thank you for having us.
Well, first of all, could you give us just a little quick summary of the play Midsummer Night's Dream for those who may not remember it?
Oh, quick summary. Well, it's actually a play that's considered sort of plotless in a way, but it deals with four young lovers. A couple of the lovers are assigned to marry each other, and they don't want to marry each other, so they run off, and the other two lovers follow them into the woods. And in the woods, they meet, they come into the fairy and live amongst the fairies. And basically, over a night, all sorts of crazy hijinks happen due to being amongst the fairies, and eventually everyone falls in love with the right person, and everyone is happy.
And they get married.
And they get married, yes. And my apologies to Shakespeare scholars out there for my synopsis of Midsummer, but I did my best.
Well, in this film, you follow the directors Ben Steinfeld and Noah Brody. They're from something called Fiasco Theater. They are directors of this play, Midsummer Night's Dream, at this facility. And they're talking at the beginning of the film about all the confusion and uncertainty that there is in the film for the players. It's funny for the audience, but kind of fuzzy for those who are in the play. They're talking with the residents early on about how to produce it, and one resident and cast member, Aideen O'Kelly, she just jumps at the chance.
What are your hopes and desires for this process and this production?
The whole idea of this, to me, is wonderful because I spent 43 years doing it, and it'd be so heaven to get back doing it and just have the heart and the soul of it, because that's where I am. I'll always be there, and it really is my whole life inside. It'd be a wonderful way of getting that back because then nothing else replaces it.
So that's Adine, who had to give up acting because she couldn't actually read the scripts anymore. What are some of the physical and emotional challenges for the residents involved in this play?
Well, they really run the gamut between sort of minor hearing problems and for Adine, actually, she has lost a lot of her sight capability, so she can no longer read a script. And although everything about every shred of her being wants to be involved in this play, it does. It is a challenge for her because she can't memorize the script, you know. So she comes up with an alternative way, and she really tries to make the best of her situation. Other people are dealing with memory issues, Alzheimer's, dementia, and even just, you know, sort of limited mobility. A couple people have pretty severe Parkinson's. So everybody's got some sort of thing that's altering their reality in a way. And that was one of the big challenges for the directors was, how do we deal with all these realities and all these abilities that are shifting even all the time?
We do get these glimpses of who they once were, you know, playbills from Broadway shows. Demo, who trained with Lee Strasberg, Uta Hagen, and Elia Kazan as a member of the Actors Studio, Bob, who danced in Damn Yankees for years. How present were those past lives at the home? I mean, did you have to prod them as filmmakers, or was it very much on display?
No, I think they're proud of what they bring in, and it's not something that they, you know, go around and presenting their resume to people. They're all kind of on equal footing, those who were acting as their career. But the home also brings in people who have no experience in the entertainment industry. If you have a family member who has been in the industry, you can apply to become a member of the home. So the players in the production run the gamut, from those who, you know, were on Broadway for years and years to those who, as Mary says, I came here as a housewife. And now I'm singing, I'm acting, I'm dancing.
Is she the one who says, I should get an agent?
Yes.
Yeah.
Can you get me an agent, she says.
While this is playing out, we get shots of bingo playing, you know, people eating, their menus and activities posted, their meds being handed out. And we get a sense of the meaning of the play for them. Do you recall when it turned from no longer this kind of little lark of an activity to something greater and much scarier for them?
I think the first week, everyone was really nervous and quiet. And by the second week, people were getting to know each other better because, you know, even though they live in the same home together, they didn't necessarily spend very much time together. So one great thing about this play is it really created community. And you could see that starting to happen in the second week where they were starting to come out of their shells and have fun and laugh. And then the third week, as everyone sort of, you know, was a little bit tired and they were getting deeper into the text, that seemed to be when things started getting challenging, you know. And so the third, fourth, fifth week, even up to, you know, the end was really difficult. But there were these really high moments, too, where people were just so excited and surprised by what they were able to do again.
You get this sense of the meaning for them, you know, many of them recalling a part of their earlier lives, some with more vigor than others. Now, here's a clip of Demo, and he's speaking with, I think it is Harold, about whether or not they should memorize the lines.
Are we memorizing these? No, I'm just asking because some people will have difficulty.
The question is that.
Because some people will have difficulty memorizing.
Are you talking about some people or are you talking about yourself?
Whatever.
You want to play bottom without memorizing it?
Of course I'm going to memorize it.
Why do you ask? Do I have to memorize? What the hell kind of acting is that? Of course you have to memorize.
Okay.
All right, gentlemen.
Okay.
All right, that is a clip from Still Dreaming. The filmmakers Jillian Spitzmiller and Hank Rogerson are with us. So Demo goes through quite a transformation. There's a kind of realization that this is his shot. What do you think was going on for him?
To me, it was actually really inspiring to watch him at his age, you know, saying, this is another opportunity for me. This is an opportunity actually for me to really put my stamp on something and to do something that matters. In another part of it, it's heartbreaking because you realize someone at his age is still trying to get something he hasn't quite attained and not necessarily in a place where it's attainable. He was seizing the day. He was taking advantage of an opportunity presented to him making the best of it as much as he could.
It was just amazing play for this setting. You know, time shifts, perception shifts, they can't be trusted. What's real and what is imagination and dreaming run through the play. And also the film. Here's a clip. This is Gloria. She's one of the most gifted actors in the whole lot. Talking to Ben, she's telling him she's leaving the home and therefore the play.
I'll stay, you know, I mean, I'll work whatever scenes you want me to do.
What's going on? Where are you going?
Arizona, to live. I have a friend who's just said, come and live with me in Arizona.
Will you still be friends with them in August? I'm sure they'd understand.
Maybe.
In all seriousness, like in the play, I can't tell right now if this is happening or if it's some kind of nightmare. No, right. I'm just teasing. So your friend is coming to pick you up or something, you're going to fly back there together?
Yes.
So many things going on in that clip. What do we learn about Gloria from that conversation?
Well, we think, you know, we take it at face value, as Ben is taking it at face value. But he has a discussion with the recreation director right after that because, as he says, everything's falling apart at the seams because Aideen has just also told him that she's having trouble memorizing and with this method that she dreamed up. And so he's also there by himself for the week. So he's having to kind of juggle all these problems that are coming up and make the best of it. And so he sits down with the recreation director afterwards, this wonderful woman named Jalili Alzate. And she kind of tells him a different story of what's going on with Gloria. So it's interesting to watch it all unfold.
Well, I'm wondering about for you. Gloria later tells you she's just come back from being away. It's not true. None of it is. And you're the filmmaker holding the camera on this woman, just showing some extreme vulnerability. I'm wondering what that experience was like for you watching these people struggle with those kind of mental and physical vulnerabilities.
Yeah, the filming of that scene with Gloria that you're speaking about, it is one of those scenes as it's happening. I know there's a part of me that just wants to get up and run. Honestly, you know, as a documentary filmmaker, you're there to capture the honesty and authenticity of what's happening before you as much as you can. And she was unbelievably vulnerable and heartbreaking in that moment. I don't have a lot of experience with it, but from what I've seen, a really honest portrayal of my memory doesn't work anymore. Hmm. In the present, ask me what I was doing when I was 8 years old, as she says, and I can tell you, but I don't remember what I did 2 seconds ago. We debated about that moment and the sort of, you know, the moral and the ethical dilemmas around that moment of someone who maybe doesn't know quite what she's saying. But that's really what her reality was at that moment. So,
and I felt too that actually that was a moment of clarity for her. Like she was really clear about what was going on with her and very honest about it.
In your previous film, Shakespeare Behind Bars, you followed a production of The Tempest. This was at a Kentucky penitentiary. And now here at the actor's home. So these two hidden populations, people that most of us don't normally see, that you turn your camera to. What is it about exposing these in the creative process that has such a draw for you as filmmakers?
I think a simple way to answer that question is that with Shakespeare and the themes that come up in his work is that he brings stuff up. whether you're dealing with forgiveness, the theme of forgiveness with a bunch of inmates, or you're dealing with the themes of perception versus reality and dreaming with a bunch of people whose faculties of perception are not at their height, it creates an atmosphere or an experience that brings up these things that people are dealing with directly in subtextual ways. You know, the themes that Shakespeare dealt with 400 years ago are still alive today. Again, Midsummer Night's Dream is thought of and performed in many, you know, in so many ways as a sex farce. But this, with this population in a senior home, it became something completely different. The film gives a whole new perspective on the play, which is really quite remarkable.
Jillian, do you have anything you want to add to that?
I think there's a thread that runs through Hank and my work, which is, we're sort of always seeking out what's on the edge. And I think there's a lot to be learned from, you know, getting out of our comfort zones, you know, both in the prison and the nursing home. It's like we are marginalizing parts of our society. And I just want to ask the question, why? And do we need to do so in such a drastic way? And I think the arts and Shakespeare, in these films anyway, is bringing people together, and it's healing people, and it's creating connections where we've tried to disassociate from these different groups.
That's the filmmaker Jillian Spitzmiller and also Hank Rogerson. Thank you very much for speaking with us today.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Jillian Spitzmiller and Hank Rogerson. Their film is called Still Dreaming, and it's going to be shown this Friday at the Hop and on July 1st at Pentangle in Woodstock, Vermont. Both of those showings will be followed by discussions with Jillian Spitzmiller and Hank Rogerson. There's much more information on the schedule of showings, and also you can watch a trailer of the film. Just go to wordofmouthradio.org. This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. Anne Abernathy doesn't do half measures. After college, she worked as a professional singer all across the country. Then she picked up the sport of luge and has since qualified for the Olympics a record 6 times. Now in her 60s, Anne is not ready to retire. In fact, she's taken up a new challenge. Producer Lauren Ober brings us the story.
On a recent weekday afternoon, Anne Abernathy is navigating a set of stairs at the Bull Run Public Shooting Center in Centerville, Virginia. With one hand on the railing and the other hand on a cane, Abernathy slowly picks her way down the stairs leading to the subterranean archery range. This isn't exactly what you expect to witness when you're meeting an Olympic hopeful. But then, the Virginia woman isn't your average athlete.
I'm 60 years old. I'm not a young pup at this.
But there are other issues beside her age and the recent knee operation that makes her hobble around. Abernathy is a total beginner at this sport. She picked up archery only 14 months ago.
I only know how to train for the Olympics. I don't know how to do something just recreational.
And so it is that Abernathy, a sexagenarian archery novice, has her sights set on the 2016 Summer Olympics in Rio de Janeiro. If she makes it, she will likely be the oldest competitor in the Games. But it won't be the first time. Abernathy is a 6-time Olympian, a fact she will tell you many times in the course of a conversation. She represented her adopted home of the U.S. Virgin Islands in the sliding sport of luge and wears a gold necklace featuring the Olympic rings as a constant reminder. At the time of her first Olympics, the 1988 Calgary Games, Abernathy was 34. She went on to compete in Albertville, Lillehammer, Nagano, Salt Lake City, and Torino.
When I first started, I didn't think Olympics. I just thought I really enjoy doing this sport. But luge takes a toll on the body. And although I really love the sport, my body had had enough.
She's not kidding about that. Since taking up luge in the 80s, Abernathy has had 19 knee operations and a smattering of other surgeries. She's had countless head injuries, and she's even broken her back. With that in mind, archery seems like a way safer option.
Here's one of the problems that I have, and it's from the back injury. If I shoot 144 arrows in a day, the elbow bends more and more and more when it needs to be straight out.
To understand Abernathy's obsession with the Olympics and with sport in general, you have to know a little something about her upbringing. She was born in Florida to a father in the Air Force and a mother who didn't think it was appropriate for girls to play sports.
Well, I love playing softball. My mom wouldn't let me. I wasn't allowed to do any sports in school. I could swim. I was allowed to swim and play tennis.
Decades later, Abernathy discovered luge during a ski trip to Lake Placid. At the 1980 Winter Olympic venue, Abernathy and some friends watched the sliders fly down the track. Soon, a luge coach sidled up to them.
And he said, anybody wants to try it, take a step forward. And immediately 18 people took a step back. And I was a little slower than the others. And I was there and I turned to the guy next to me and we looked at each other and I said, why not?
And so began Ann Abernathy's 20-year luge career. She never medaled at the Olympics, but she did get to travel to competitions around the world. Over the years, she picked up a nickname, Grandma Luge.
Keep the wrist up. Come on.
At the Bull Run Shooting Center, Abernathy is working with a fellow Olympian to hone her newfound archery skills. Ruth Rowe competed in the 1984 Summer Games in Los Angeles as a member of the U.S. archery team, and the pair make a perfect combo. They tease and bicker like an old married couple, and they have their own way of communicating.
Ruth will see me across the room and she'll say, steer.
Everybody else goes,
and everybody goes, what? And what she means is use the same muscles that I use to steer with. So we have our own language that we were able to pick up by combining both of the sports. It got me to World Cup last year within my first 12 months.
What are you trying to aim? Blank bill, you don't aim.
I know. It just doesn't feel right unless I do aim at something.
Look.
I'm looking.
Yeah.
The 66-year-old Roe seems to understand her student's particular set of challenges. She's had to adjust the way Abernathy shoots because the former luger can no longer fully straighten her right arm. But Roe believes in her.
She has the discipline of training. She's had the experience in high-level competition. She knows how to handle herself mentally.
But what might make Abernathy's march to Rio even harder than it already is the fact that she's low on cash. Unlike many other Olympic hopefuls who ink sponsorship deals with shoe or car or yogurt companies, Abernathy has to find the money to compete. Olympic training is not cheap.
It's a massive expense. And I'm not exactly sure how I'm going to get there. I'm getting there on a shoestring right now. And I'm hoping that somebody will jump on board and help me get there. When I got to my last Olympics in luge, I literally got there one t-shirt at a time.
To that end, Abernathy was, until recently, couch surfing at a friend's house in Falls Church, Virginia to cut down on expenses. And then a couple of weeks ago, a family in nearby Vienna adopted the Olympian, allowing her to stay in their house rent-free while she trains with Ruth Rowe at Bull Run. It's just one of many sacrifices Abernathy is making to hit the bullseye on this particular dream.
What happens if you don't make it?
I don't even think that way. That's not... My brain doesn't even... I don't know how to answer that question. There is no not making it.
And that story was produced by Lauren Ober. Thank you so much for your listening time today. There's so much more to hear and explore at wordofmouthradio.org. That's where you can also find your subscription to the Word of Mouth podcast. You can also sign up for it by searching Word of Mouth NHPR in iTunes. And if you like it, we encourage you to write a review, to pass it on, and to tell a friend. After all, the best suggestions travel by word of mouth. I'm Virginia Prescott. Until next time, this is Word of Mouth on New Hampshire Public Radio.
Word of Mouth is produced by Taylor Quimby,
Logan Shannon,
Molly Donahue,
and senior producer Maureen McMurray.
Our intern is Fiona Shea.
The views expressed in this program are those of the individuals and not those of NHPR,
its Board of Trustees,
or its underwriters.
Word of Mouth is a production of New Hampshire
Public Radio.